Welcome, Deep Divers. We're about to plunge into a life so rich, so full of twists and turns, that it almost defies belief. We're talking about a man who holds a truly unique place in American history. Not just the sixth president of the United States, but the only former president ever elected to the House of Representatives, serving there with, well, just unwavering dedication until the very day he died.
It's an unprecedented political journey, isn't it?
It really is. What kind of drive, what kind of commitment to public service leads to such an extraordinary trajectory?
It's an astonishing testament to his character. I mean, most would consider returning to Congress after holding the nation's highest office a step down, maybe even an embarrassment.
Right, think so.
But for John Quincy Adams, it seems it was a renewed opportunity to serve. His willingness to take on that role again, not really out of political ambition, it seems, but out of this deep sense of civic duty, it really sets the stage for understanding the man.
Absolutely. Today, our mission is to embark on a deep dive into the extraordinary life of John Quincy Adams. As we'll soon discover, his impact on American history extended far beyond his single, often tumultuous term in the White House. We're drawing from a rich collection of historical accounts, biographical details, political analyses, sources that paint a vivid picture of a man often underestimated and perhaps profoundly misunderstood.
Yeah.
We want to unpack the many layers of his career, you know, from a globe-trotting child diplomat in Europe to a fervent anti-slavery advocate on the floor of Congress.
Yeah.
We aim to uncover the surprising insights his story offers about American history, the evolving nature of leadership, and the enduring struggle for national identity.
And as we navigate his story, I think a central paradox will emerge. It's something historians always grapple with. How is it that Adams is so widely celebrated as one of America's greatest diplomats and secretaries of state? I mean, a true architect of our foreign policy.
Yeah, absolutely. Top tier.
Yet he's often ranked by historians as merely an average president, maybe even below average sometimes.
It's quite the contrast.
It is. And this isn't just a historical curiosity. It's a profound question about the qualities we value in leadership, right? Was he simply the wrong man at the wrong time, or did his very strengths as a statesman, his intellectualism, his maybe rigidity prove to be liabilities in the new rough-and-tumble world of partisan politics?
That's a great question.
That tension, that contrast between his unparalleled success in one arena and his struggles in another, it offers a powerful lens through which to examine his entire life, I think.
That's the fascinating thread we'll be pulling on throughout our conversation. So let's begin at the very beginning. John Quincy Adams was born on July 11, 1767 in Braintree, Massachusetts. Now Quincy, actually.
Right.
He was the eldest son of two of the most formidable figures in American history, John and Abigail Adams. He was actually named after his mother's maternal grandfather, Colonel John Quincy, a respected figure in Massachusetts colonial politics.
So pressure from the start, you could say.
Oh, definitely. That's quite a legacy to inherit, and even more so the expectations that came with it. But here's where his story takes a truly unconventional turn for a future American president. Young Adams spent much of his childhood not in the burgeoning United States, but immersed in the heart of Europe.
Indeed. And from the remarkably tender age of 10, this is 1778, he was accompanying his father, John Adams, who, of course, would become the second U.S. president on these crucial diplomatic missions, first to France, then later to the Netherlands.
Can you imagine? 10 years old.
It's incredible. A mere boy thrust into the grand courts and complex negotiations that were literally shaping the future of a new nation. He wasn't just, you know, tagging along. He was observing, learning languages, multiple languages, soaking up cultures, and internalizing the intricate dance of international relations firsthand.
Wow.
This early immersive exposure was practically unheard of for a young American at the time. It profoundly shaped his global perspective and instilled in him a unique understanding of foreign affairs that really set him apart from almost all of his contemporaries.
It's incredible to think of the impact that must have had. He was effectively trained from childhood for a diplomatic career. This isn't just theoretical knowledge from books. This is real-world, high-stakes experience at an age when most children are, you know, just learning their multiplication tables.
Exactly. It's no wonder this upbringing directly prefigured his later unparalleled success as a diplomat. It offered him a foundation that few others possessed. Really, none of the other early presidents had anything like it.
Absolutely. Yeah. His education, too, was as rigorous as his early travels, wasn't it?
Oh, intensely rigorous. He wasn't simply sent off to a conventional boarding school. He was educated by tutors, including his cousin James Thaxter and his father's law clerk, Nathan Rice. During his time abroad, he wasn't idle. He attended schools, including the famous Leiden University, and diligently studied law, French, Greek, Latin.
The classical education.
The full classical education, yeah. Upon his return to America, he graduated second in his class from Harvard College in 1787. This was a mind being honed from every possible angle.
And what truly captures his intellectual discipline, I think, is his lifelong commitment to journaling. He started a diary in 1779, a practice he maintained almost without interruption until just before his death in 1848.
Just amazing.
That's a truly remarkable, nearly 70-year record of American history, viewed through the eyes of someone who was often at the very center of events.
And his father, John Adams, deeply encouraged him in this intellectual development, pushing him to read classical authors like Thucydides, the great historian of the Peloponnesian War, and Hugo Grotius, often called the father of international law. And John Quincy didn't just read them. He was actively translating Virgil, Horace, Plutarch, Aristotle.
Wow.
It speaks volumes about his intellectual rigor and his introspective nature. This wasn't merely rote learning. It was a profound engagement with the enduring ideals that shaped Western civilization. He viewed the pursuit of knowledge not just as a means to a career, but as a path to personal understanding and, importantly, civic virtue. His deep study of rhetoric, for instance, informed his understanding of public speaking's vital role in a republic. This would become both a strength and, arguably, a challenge in his later political life.
All this preparation certainly paid off. After his formidable education, Adams returned to America and established a successful legal practice in Boston in 1790, achieving financial independence relatively quickly. But he wasn't destined to remain a lawyer for long, was he?
No, the call to public service, especially diplomacy, was too strong. In 1794, President George Washington, recognizing his unique talents and that European experience, appointed him U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands.
Quite an honor from Washington himself.
Absolutely. He later served as ambassador to Portugal in 1796, although he never actually went there due to a change in plans, and then to Prussia from 1797 to 1801 during his father's presidency.
Ah, serving under his own father. That must have been interesting.
It's worth noting that Adams initially considered declining the Netherlands post. He seemed hesitant about such a public role, but ultimately took his father's advice. And even in these early diplomatic assignments, his strategic thinking was evident. During the turbulent French Revolutionary Wars, he consistently urged American neutrality, believing the U.S. would benefit economically by staying out of European conflicts.
Sound advice.
He secured essential loans for the U.S. in the Netherlands and negotiated a new treaty of amity and commerce with Prussia in 1799. His insightful letters about the Prussian region of Silesia were so well regarded, they were actually published as a book in 1801, showcasing his keen observational skills and analytical prowess early on.
So this period truly solidified his diplomatic skills and demonstrated his independent thinking. He wasn't afraid to advise his own father during the quasi-war with France, that undeclared naval war between 1798 and 1800, where U.S. merchant ships were being seized by French privateers. He advocated a balanced, pragmatic approach.
Right. He wasn't just echoing his father's Federalist line.
No. And this early focus on commercial relations and strategic neutrality clearly foreshadowed his later presidential interest in trade and his foundational foreign policy principles.
And on a more personal note, it was during his time in Europe, specifically in London, that he met and married Louisa Catherine Johnson in 1797.
Louisa.
Louisa, by the way, holds the distinction of becoming the first lady born outside the United States. She was born in London to an American father, a merchant from Maryland, and an English mother.
It must have been incredibly challenging for her, navigating that public life in a new country, especially coming into the Adams family. I read that his parents, John and Abigail, initially disapproved of his choice.
Yes, they did. Which offers a glimpse into the formidable Adams family dynamics, doesn't it?
It certainly does. But John Quincy stood firm, demonstrating a personal resolve that often contrasted with his more reserved public persona. And there was a further complication, wasn't there? Something about her father.
Yes, her father-in-law, Joshua Johnson, faced financial difficulties and actually fled England to escape creditors, leaving Adams without the promised dowry, much to Louise's embarrassment, apparently. Yet Adams noted no regrets about the marriage in his diary, which is quite telling.
It really is. It introduces us to the woman who would stand by him through his long, often tumultuous public life, and it shows his unwavering commitment on a personal level beyond just politics.
It speaks to his deep sense of loyalty and a determination that transcended superficial considerations, I think.
So after this incredible start, this diplomatic grounding, Adams eventually returned to the U.S. in 1801. He briefly reestablished his legal practice in Boston, served in the Massachusetts Senate in 1802, and was then elected to the U.S. Senate in 1803. But he wouldn't remain a Federalist like his father for long, would he? This marked a significant turning point.
Not at all. This period highlights a crucial defining aspect of his character, his fierce political independence. Despite his Federalist upbringing and family ties, he broke with the party over foreign policy, consistently prioritizing what he saw as the national interest over party loyalty.
Even when it hurt him politically.
Especially when it hurt him politically. For instance, he supported the Jefferson administration's Louisiana Purchase in 1803, a move most Federalists vehemently opposed. He later backed Jefferson's Non-Importation Act of 1806 and the extremely controversial Embargo Act of 1807. Both measures were aimed at asserting American neutrality and sovereignty against European powers, Britain and France mainly, but they were deeply unpopular, especially in New England, his home base, and with his own Federalist Party.
So he was really swimming against the tide.
Completely. This defiance, this willingness to go against the grain and alienate his own party, came at a significant personal cost. The Federalist-controlled Massachusetts legislature, furious with his independent streak, elected his successor several months early, effectively forcing his resignation from the Senate in 1808.
Wow. Pushed out by his own party.
Essentially, yes. This willingness to defy party lines would be a recurring theme and, frankly, a significant challenge throughout his entire career.
It's remarkable how early he demonstrated that independent streak, valuing principle, or at least his interpretation of the national interest, over party affiliation. And it wasn't just politics for him either during this time. While serving as a senator, this polymath actually found time to serve as a professor of logic at Brown University.
Incredible.
And then as the first Boylston professor of rhetoric and oratory at Harvard, he even published his lectures on rhetoric and oratory in 1810.
These lectures drew heavily from classical ideals of civic eloquence. He emphasized the necessity of liberty for rhetoric to truly flourish, and its importance as a unifying element for a new nation. It really underscores his intellectual foundation and how he viewed the vital role of public speaking in a republic, not as a tool for manipulation, but for reasoned debate and civic engagement.
A very high-minded view.
Extremely. And what's particularly significant is how this classical, principled perspective on oratory would increasingly clash with the emerging mass democracy of the Jacksonian era, which, let's face it, valued popular appeal and emotional rallying much more than refined Ciceronian eloquence. He was, in many ways, an intellectual aristocrat preparing for a democratic age that wasn't quite ready for his style.
So, despite his break with the Federalists and his forced resignation, President James Madison, a Democratic Republican, recognized Adams's immense talent and, frankly, his unique qualifications. In 1809, he appointed Adams as the first U.S. minister plenipotentiary to Russia.
Which was a huge appointment. It showed the earned goodwill and respect he commanded across the political spectrum, even from the party he had opposed on some issues.
Definitely. How did he fare in Russia?
Very well, actually. Adams quickly established a productive working relationship with the Russian Chancellor, Nikolai Rumyantsev, and even developed a friendly rapport with Tsar Alexander himself.
Befriending the Tsar? Not bad.
Not bad at all. From this crucial post in St. Petersburg, he observed Napoleon's disastrous invasion of Russia in 1812, giving him unique insights into European power dynamics and the fragility of empires.
A front row seat to history.
Absolutely. And interestingly, in 1811, President Madison even nominated him as an associate justice to the Supreme Court.
Wow, the Supreme Court.
But Adams declined. He preferred to remain active in politics and diplomacy. This rejection of a Supreme Court seat, which offers life tenure and immense prestige, really underscores his profound passion for active public service, particularly in foreign policy. His influence with Tsar Alexander I, cultivated during this period, would also prove critical in the coming years, particularly regarding the War of 1812.
And critical it was, because just a few years later, Adams was called upon to help negotiate an end to that very war, the War of 1812. He was appointed to the American delegation, and these tough negotiations began in Ghent, in modern-day Belgium, in mid-1814. By all accounts, it was a difficult situation, with the British initially making some pretty aggressive demands.
It certainly was. Adams, though the nominal head of the delegation, often found himself clashing with other members, particularly the fiery Henry Clay, over negotiation tactics and priorities. Clay was more focused on Western interests, Adams, perhaps more on maritime rights and boundaries.
Always internal tensions in delegations like that.
Always. Yet he successfully navigated these difficult waters alongside Albert Gallatin, James A. Bayard, Henry Clay, and Jonathan Russell. The American delegation stood firm and rejected British demands for creating an Indian barrier state in the Great Lakes region, and they resisted other significant territorial concessions like claims to parts of Maine or navigation rights on the Mississippi.
They held the line.
They did. The treaty, signed on Christmas Eve, 1814, ended hostilities on the basis of status quo antebellum, basically a return to pre-war conditions. No territory changed hands, none of the major pre-war issues like impressment were resolved directly in the treaty, but...
But while the U.S. didn't gain any specific territorial concessions, just surviving a war against the world's strongest naval power, the British Empire, without losing territory... That was a victory in itself, right?
Absolutely. It significantly bolstered national confidence and international standing. And Adams's firmness, his meticulous preparation, his deep knowledge of international law, and his diplomatic skill in those tense negotiations were absolutely pivotal in achieving that outcome. He helped safeguard American sovereignty and prevent potentially damaging territorial losses. It's a real testament to his negotiating prowess under immense pressure.
His reputation must have soared after Ghent.
Precisely. It continued to grow exponentially. In May 1815, President Madison appointed him U.S. ambassador or minister to Great Britain, a top diplomatic post.
From negotiating peace with them to being ambassador to them.
Exactly. There, he further solidified Anglo-American relations by negotiating a limited trade agreement. Then, in 1817, the newly elected president, James Monroe, entering his presidency, aiming for what became known as the era of good feelings, and seeking national unity, chose the respected and uniquely experienced Adams as his Secretary of State.
What a crucial role.
And Monroe explicitly wanted a Northerner in this critical role, someone whose qualifications were undeniable, to balance the Virginian dominance. Adams fit the bill perfectly.
This appointment was a massive testament to Adams's exceptional diplomatic reputation, wasn't it? It demonstrated a nonpartisan approach from Monroe, at least initially, at a time when the country genuinely needed it, especially after the divisiveness of the War of 1812.
Totally agree. Adams's extensive European experience, his deep understanding of international law, his proven negotiating skills, it all made him uniquely qualified for a post that was critical to post-war of 1812 American stability and, importantly, expansion. He was truly the right man in the right place at the right time, poised to define America's place in the world.
And define it, he did. Adams served for 8 years as Secretary of State, the full two terms under Monroe, from 1817 to 1825. This period is widely regarded as one of the most consequential in U.S. history for foreign policy. Maybe the most consequential.
You could easily make that argument. He oversaw key successes that established foundational principles still recognized today. Consider the Convention of 1818 with the United Kingdom, a landmark agreement.
Right. What did that do again?
Well, it did several crucial things. It limited naval armaments on the Great Lakes, reducing future friction there. It definitively defined the Canada-United States border along the 49th parallel, all the way from the Lake of the Woods to the Rocky Mountains. And it established joint occupation of the Oregon country for 10 years. This significantly improved U.S.-British relations and clarified our northern frontier. A huge deal.
Okay, huge. And then here's where his strategic brilliance, maybe even ruthlessness, truly shines. The Adams-Onis Treaty of 1819, also known as the Transcontinental Treaty. This is where the U.S. acquired Florida from Spain.
Yes, but the path to it was anything but straightforward. Adams masterfully used a crisis, largely created by Andrew Jackson, to his advantage. When Jackson launched unauthorized military actions in Spanish-controlled Florida, ostensibly chasing Seminoles but also seizing Spanish posts.
Which caused a huge international incident.
Exactly. Adams didn't condemn him, unlike many in Monroe's cabinet. Instead, he boldly defended Nelson's actions as necessary self-defense, arguing that Spain's inability to control the territory had created a vacuum that threatened American security. He basically told Spain, control your territory or cede it.
That's some diplomatic hardball.
It effectively forced Spain's hand, leading them to sell Florida to the U.S. But that wasn't all. In the same treaty, Adams secured Spain's claims to the Oregon country, renouncing vague Spanish claims north of the 42nd parallel, and in return, the U.S. renounced its equally vague claims to Texas. This established a clear western boundary for the Louisiana Purchase all the way to the Pacific.
The Transcontinental Treaty, it literally defined the U.S. from coast to coast for the first time.
Precisely. It was a masterstroke. He balanced Southern desire for Florida with Northern interest in the Pacific Northwest, seeing its potential as a spur for future Asian trade. And what's often overlooked, but quite telling, is that Adams privately worried about slavery's expansion into these newly acquired territories, even as he was securing them for the nation. He wrote about it in his diary.
So even then, that conflict was weighing on him.
It reveals a man wrestling with the moral implications of national growth, even while executing his duties with strategic precision.
And of course, we can't talk about his time as Secretary of State without mentioning the Monroe Doctrine of 1823.
Yeah.
How central was Adams to that?
He was absolutely central. He was the principal architect behind it. He strongly urged President Monroe to issue a unilateral American declaration rather than making a joint statement with Great Britain as the British had proposed. Adams wanted the U.S. to stand on its own.
What was the core message?
It publicly declared U.S. opposition to any future European colonization or attempts to retake over territory in the Americas. It basically said the Western Hemisphere was closed to further European colonization. At the same time, it committed the U.S. to neutrality and strictly European affairs. It carved out a distinctly American sphere of influence.
Oh, bold move for a relatively young nation.
Extremely bold. This doctrine, largely built on Adams's ideas and forceful advocacy within the cabinet, marked the U.S.'s first major claim to hemispheric influence. It represented a significant psychological shift, turning America's gaze away from entanglement in European power struggles and towards its own hemisphere. It truly established foundational principles of U.S. foreign policy.
What you'll talk about today.
Exactly. It demonstrated his remarkable foresight in shaping the nation's international posture for generations to come.
Beyond the grand sweep of foreign policy, I find it fascinating that his intellectual curiosity extended to incredibly practical matters, too. You mentioned his interest in standardization. For example, he produced this massive, incredibly detailed report for Congress on weights and measures.
Oh, yes, a monumental piece of work.
And in it, he actually advocated for the adoption of the metric system back in the 1820s.
He did. He saw the logic and universality of it. It's a perfect example of that blend of domestic policy focus, a global perspective, and a scientific rational outlook that was just so far ahead of his time. It shows a mind constantly seeking order, efficiency, and improvement, both domestically and internationally.
A polymath indeed. Constantly thinking about how to improve and rationalize systems, whether in governance or in everyday commerce.
You got it.
Well, with such an illustrious diplomatic career, arguably one of the greatest secretaries of state ever, it was perhaps inevitable that John Quincy Adams would run for president himself. But his path to the White House in 1824 was anything but smooth. This was a truly tumultuous election that signaled a dramatic shift in American politics.
It was indeed, and it really set the stage for a very difficult and ultimately frustrating presidency. The 1824 election was chaotic. The old system of congressional caucus nominations had broken down, and the era of good feelings devolved into factionalism. You had four prominent Democratic-Republican candidates essentially running against each other.
Right. Remind us who they were again.
You had Adams, the seasoned Secretary of State. You had Andrew Jackson, the immensely popular war hero from Tennessee. You had William H. Crawford of Georgia, the Secretary of the Treasury, who had been the initial favorite of many party insiders. And then you had Henry Clay of Kentucky, the charismatic Speaker of the House.
Four major contenders from the same nominal party.
Exactly. And crucially, no one won an outright majority of electoral votes. Jackson actually won a plurality of both the popular vote and the electoral votes, but not the required majority.
So what happens then?
According to the 12th Amendment of the Constitution, the election gets thrown into the House of Representatives. They choose from the top three electoral vote getters. That meant Adams, Jackson, and Crawford. Clay was fourth, so he was out, but as Speaker of the House, he still held enormous influence.
Okay, and this is where the infamous corrupt bargain comes into play, right?
Yeah.
A political scandal that would just haunt Adams for his entire term?
Precisely. Clay, who personally disliked Jackson and whose American system economic vision aligned more closely with Adams's ideas, threw his support behind Adams in the House vote. Adams won the contingent election on the first ballot. And then shortly after taking office, Adams controversially appointed Henry Clay as his Secretary of State, traditionally seen as the stepping stone to the presidency.
Oof, that looks bad.
It looked terrible to Jackson's supporters. They immediately cried foul, unleashing furious accusations of a corrupt bargain. They claimed Adams had essentially traded the top cabinet post for Clay's crucial support in the House election. Whether a specific deal was struck is still debated by historians, but the perception was devastating.
Yeah, perception is reality in politics sometimes.
And what's truly insightful here is how this election and the cloud of perceived illegitimacy it cast severely hampered Adams's presidency from the very start. It fueled an intense partisan animosity, particularly with Andrew Jackson and his rapidly organizing supporters. It basically marked the definitive end of the era of good feelings, that period of relative political harmony.
It just shattered it.
Completely. This whole episode powerfully illustrates how the political landscape was dramatically shifting. It was moving away from deference to established leaders and elite consensus towards a more contentious mass democracy, where party loyalty, popular appeal, organization, and even personal attacks held increasing sway. For a man of Adams's character, devoted to principle and reason, and frankly, kind of aloof.
Yeah, not a backslapper.
Not at all. It was a profoundly unsettling and challenging new political world for him. He was almost doomed before he truly began.
Despite this rocky and contentious start, Adams came into office with an incredibly ambitious and forward-thinking vision for the nation. On March 4, 1825, he was inaugurated, and notably, as you pointed out, he departed from tradition by placing his hand on a book of constitutional law instead of a Bible.
A symbolic choice, perhaps.
Maybe signaling his commitment to reason and the rule of law above all else. He adopted a distinctly post-partisan tone in his inaugural address, promising to avoid party building and politically motivated appointments, much to the chagrin of supporters like Clay, who wanted rewards for their allies. And then he proposed this elaborate program of what he called internal improvements, a grand plan for national development using federal power.
His agenda, which later became closely associated with Clay's American system, was truly grand and progressive for its time. It reflected his deep belief in the positive role of the federal government for national advancement.
What did it include?
Oh, a whole range of things. Federally funded roads, ports, and canals to tie the nation together economically. Think infrastructure, but also the establishment of a national university, a national naval academy, a national astronomical observatory, he called them lighthouses of the sky, and even suggested creating a Department of the Interior to manage national resources and exploration.
Wow, that's incredibly far-reaching.
It was. He argued that the General Welfare Clause of the Constitution provided broad authority for these projects, and he planned to fund them primarily through Western land sales and tariff revenue. It was a vision designed to unite disparate regional interests through a thriving national economy, and also to promote scientific progress and national prestige.
That's a vision far ahead of its time, emphasizing national unity through infrastructure and intellectual advancement. He clearly believed in a strong federal government playing a direct role in national development. But that ambitious vision largely met with congressional gridlock and the rise of fierce partisan opposition, didn't it?
Yeah.
It sounds like his principled, maybe naive, nonpartisan approach was clashing hard with the new political realities.
Absolutely. The corrupt bargain accusations had poisoned the well from the start. Jackson's supporters in Congress, led by figures like Martin Van Buren, who were building the future Democratic Party, were determined to obstruct Adams's agenda and ensure Jackson's victory in 1828.
So built-in opposition.
Built-in and very effective. Most of Adams's ambitious proposals were met with staunch resistance and were ultimately defeated in Congress. Opposition came from various quarters. Strict constitutionalists championing states' rights, who viewed federal intervention as an overreach. Jacksonian Democrats opposing Adams on principle. Those ideologically opposed to central economic planning. And significantly, Southerners who feared that a powerful federal government undertaking such broad initiatives could eventually interfere with slavery or advance a hidden abolitionist agenda.
The slavery issue lurking again.
Always. For example, his proposals for a national university, the observatory, uniform weights and measures, they never even received votes in Congress. The Naval Academy proposal passed the Senate, but was defeated in the House over concerns about cost and, believe it or not, fears of degeneracy and corruption of public morality among naval officers concentrated in one place.
That's incredible. So this era marked the definitive split of the old Democratic-Republican Party, right?
Yes. It fractured completely into the National Republican Party, which supported Adams and Clay in their vision of active federal government, and Andrew Jackson's burgeoning Democratic Party, which emphasized states' rights, limited government, and catered more to popular sentiment. This really solidified the foundations of the second party system that would dominate American politics for decades.
The Democrats versus eventually the Whigs.
Exactly. And what's particularly poignant about Adams's presidency, looking back, is that his steadfast refusal to engage in patronage or party building, his adherence to an idealized nonpartisan approach, trying to govern above the fray, ultimately made him an ineffective political organizer in this rapidly changing system.
His principles worked against him.
In a way, yes. He was a statesman, deeply concerned with the long-term national good as he saw it, but he wasn't a politician in the emerging sense of mass organization, mobilization, and, frankly, playing the political game.
Yep.
His principles, in a cruel twist of fate, became perhaps his greatest political vulnerability at that moment.
Still, it wasn't all gridlock. You mentioned some things did get done. Despite the overwhelming opposition, Adams did oversee some significant infrastructure projects, pushing through what he could, didn't he?
He did. He was persistent. He presided over major repairs and extensions on the National Road, the Cumberland Road, a critical artery connecting the Potomac and Ohio rivers. He saw the beginning of significant canal constructions, like the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal. And remarkably, the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, which is actually the first major passenger and freight railroad in the United States, got its charter and began construction during his term. So his vision for internal improvements wasn't entirely unrealized, even if the Grand National System failed.
Because some practical progress was made.
Yes, important progress. However, domestically, he also faced the highly contentious tariff of 1828. This was a real political headache.
The Tariff of Abominations, as its opponents called it.
Precisely. Adams actually signed this bill, but it was largely devised by Jacksonians in Congress as a kind of political trap. They loaded it with high rates on imported raw materials like wool and iron to appeal to manufacturers in the mid-Atlantic and western states, but they expected New Englanders, Adams's base, and Southerners to oppose it, potentially splitting Adams's support.
Clever politics.
Very clever. But it backfired slightly when enough New Englanders voted for it to pass. The tariff was widely denounced in the South, particularly in South Carolina, as economically crippling, favoring northern industries at their expense, and constitutionally questionable. This further alienated his southern support and dramatically intensified regional tensions over federal power and economic policy. It really laid the groundwork for the nullification crisis under Jackson.
Another sign of the growing sectional divide. And what about his Indian policy? That was another incredibly contentious issue in this period of westward expansion.
Adams held a remarkably progressive stance for his time, certainly compared to Jackson. He generally sought the gradual assimilation of Native Americans through consensual agreements and believed in respecting treaty obligations made by the federal government.
That put him at odds with states like Georgia, didn't it?
Absolutely. Most notably, he clashed with the governor of Georgia, George Troop, over the Treaty of Indian Springs. This was a fraudulent agreement that Troop had basically forced upon a small faction of the Muscogee Creek Nation to cede their remaining lands in Georgia. Adams declared the treaty invalid because it wasn't agreed to by the legitimate Creek leadership. He intervened, sent federal troops to prevent Georgia from surveying the land prematurely, and negotiated a new, more equitable treaty in Washington, though it still resulted in the Creeks ceding most of their Georgia land eventually.
So we stood up to the state, at least initially.
He did. He averted a potentially violent federal-state showdown and upheld, for a time, the principle of federal authority in treaty matters. It shows his principled stand on human rights and the rule of law, even when it meant clashing with a powerful state governor and popular sentiment pushing for removal. It contrasts sharply with Jackson's later approach.
And his foreign policy, beyond the grand ambitions of the American system, how did that fare amidst all the domestic turmoil?
Well, his focus remained on expanding American trade and influence peacefully. He successfully negotiated more reciprocity treaties, promoting trade with nations like Denmark, Prussia, the Hanseatic League, and the Federal Republic of Central America. He also established commercial agreements with the Kingdom of Hawaii and Tahiti.
So, some quiet successes on the trade front.
Yes, building on his work as Secretary of State. However, his administration's major effort to reopen trade with the British West Indies, a long-thought goal for American merchants, ultimately failed due to diplomatic missteps and British intransigence. This was seen as a significant failure and dealt a blow to his administration's prestige, providing more ammunition for his critics who painted him as ineffective.
And then there was the Congress of Panama in 1826. That sounds like a big idea. What was that about?
It was a potentially visionary initiative championed by Adams and Secretary of State Clay. Simon Bolivar had called for a conference of the newly independent republics of Latin America to meet in Panama to discuss cooperation, mutual defense, and shared principles. Adams wanted the U.S. to attend, hoping to inaugurate a kind of good neighborhood policy based on mutual respect and shared democratic ideals in the hemisphere.
Sounds positive. What went wrong?
It got completely bogged down in partisan politics and sectionalism in Congress. Funding for the U.S. delegation and the nominations themselves became entangled in bitter political battles. Many Southerners, for instance, vehemently opposed any U.S. involvement, particularly because delegates from Haiti, a republic established through a successful slave revolt, were expected to attend. They saw association with Haiti as a dangerous precedent and feared discussions might touch on slavery or the slave trade.
So slavery derailed it again.
Largely, yes, along with general opposition to Adams and fears of foreign entanglements. The political infighting was so severe and Senate delays so protracted that by the time the U.S. delegation was finally approved and dispatched, the Congress of Panama had already concluded. They never even reached it.
Wow, a missed opportunity.
Perhaps. It's a prime example of how sectionalism and the intensely partisan atmosphere crippled his administration's foreign policy initiatives, even those that align with his earlier principles of hemispheric leadership. It also connects back to that famous quote attributed to him as Secretary of State, "America goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy." This reveals the nuance of his foreign policy principles, a desire for influence and cooperation, but always tempered by caution against interventionism and increasingly hampered by domestic politics.
All these challenges, the corrupt bargain legacy, the congressional gridlock, the tariff fight, the failed initiatives.
Yeah.
It all converged, culminating in his resounding re-election defeat in 1828 to Andrew Jackson.
It was a landslide for Jackson. He won 178 of 261 electoral votes and just under 56% of the popular vote. Adams's loss made him the second one-term president after his own father. It was a brutal campaign, too.
How so?
This election truly marked that seismic shift in American politics we talked about, ushering in the Jacksonian era, and solidifying the second-party system Democrats versus national Republicans who would soon morph into the Whigs. The campaign became incredibly nasty, dominated by personal attacks and vitriol rather than substantive issues. Jackson's highly effective party apparatus, brilliantly organized by figures like Martin Van Buren, skillfully leveraged Jackson's immense popularity as a war hero and man of the people, while relentlessly painting Adams as an elitist, out of touch, aristocratic, and corrupt due to the bargain.
And how did Adams respond to this new style of campaigning?
He didn't, really. That's the telling part. Clinging to his older ideal of nonpartisan leadership and believing that issues, not personalities, should decide elections, Adams largely refused to adapt to these modern campaign techniques. He avoided public functions, saw active campaigning as beneath the dignity of the office, and didn't invest public or private funds in pro-administration newspapers, believing it was improper to try and buy public opinion.
So he stood on principle, but it cost him dearly.
Exactly. His principled stand against overt partisanship, ironically, contributed directly to his downfall in an era where party machinery, popular mobilization, and direct appeals to voters were becoming paramount.
And the voter turnout surged, didn't it?
Incredibly so. It roughly tripled that of 1824. It truly reflected a new level of popular engagement spurred by the removal of property qualifications for voting in many states and a new kind of politics driven by party organization. And Adams, demonstrating his utter distaste for the whole affair, and perhaps the man who defeated him, famously did not attend Jackson's inauguration.
That's a pretty clear message of his disappointment and disillusionment, isn't it? A very public snub.
A very clear, very public one. It highlighted the depth of the political chasm that had opened, and perhaps Adams's personal struggle with the changing and, in his view, degrading nature of American democracy.
You'd think, after such a bruising defeat, being repudiated by the voters, and being a former president at the age of 61, John Quincy Adams would have retired from public life. He was deeply hurt by his defeat, understandably, and even more so by the tragic suicide of his eldest son, George Washington Adams, in 1829, shortly after the election loss.
A terrible blow on top of the political one.
He initially considered retirement, retreating to his family home in Quincy, but he grew restless, didn't he? He felt his career was unfinished, that his purpose was not yet fulfilled. He just couldn't stay idle.
Yes, and this is where he embarks on the most unprecedented and, I would argue, the most impactful chapter of his entire life. It's truly remarkable. Despite the prevailing opinion, an opinion shared even by his own wife, Louisa, and his youngest son, Charles Francis, that former presidents should not seek a lower office, that it was somehow undignified.
Right, you'd expect them to fade away gracefully.
Exactly. Adams decided to run for and won election to the U.S. House of Representatives from his home district in Massachusetts in 1830. He served there continuously from 1831 until his death on the floor of the House in 1848, winning 9 consecutive terms.
That is absolutely astounding. He remains the only former president to be elected back into Congress.
Yeah.
It's an act of unparalleled civic dedication, really.
It was a powerful statement that, for him, public service was not about status or holding the highest office, but was a lifelong commitment to the Republic. This decision profoundly shaped his legacy and offered him a new, often unexpected, platform for influence. It's where he earned that famous nickname, Old Man Eloquent. He wasn't fading away. In many ways, he was just getting started on his most significant work.
So how did he operate in the House? What were his affiliations?
Well, his political affiliations continued to evolve as he sought allies against what he perceived as the executive tyranny and damaging policies of the Jackson administration. He initially affiliated loosely with the short-lived Anti-Masonic Party in the early 1830s, a movement fueled by opposition to secret societies and Jacksonianism. Then he naturally gravitated towards the emerging Whig Party in the mid-1830s, which united various factions opposed to President Jackson and his successor, Martin Van Buren, essentially, the successor to his old National Republican Party.
And did he wield influence?
He did, though often as an independent voice, even within the Whigs. He became chair of the powerful Committee on Commerce and Manufactures early on and played a role in the nullification crisis, that fierce debate where South Carolina declared the federal tariffs of 1828 and 1832 null and void within its borders, asserting states' rights to disregard federal law.
What was his stance there?
He strongly opposed nullification as a threat to the Union. He actually helped draft and pass the Tariff of 1832, which lowered rates significantly in an attempt to defuse tensions and appease the South. But he was profoundly appalled by the outcome of the crisis, particularly the Compromise Tariff of 1833, negotiated by Clay, which gradually lowered tariffs further. Adams felt it was a capitulation to South Carolina's threats and evidence of the undue influence of Southern states, driven by their desire to protect slavery in challenging federal authority.
So this experience with nullification clearly deepened his conviction that Southerners were exercising disproportionate control over the federal government and were using states' rights as a shield for slavery.
Absolutely. It pushed him towards a more direct, unwavering confrontation with the issue of states' rights and, most importantly, the institution of slavery itself. Here in the House, freed from presidential constraints, he truly found his moral voice, didn't he?
He did. And it's this late life period that really solidifies his moral legacy for many people. Adams became increasingly, relentlessly critical of slavery and Southern leaders. He used his congressional platform to fight against it with a moral fervor and a constitutional mastery that few contemporaries could match. He emerged as the most prominent national political leader opposing slavery during this pivotal period leading up to the 1840s.
And what's truly fascinating are his private thoughts, recorded decades before this public battle really heated up. In his diary entry from 1820, while the Missouri Compromise was being debated, he wrote something incredibly prescient. He observed that the debate over slavery, quote, betrayed the secret of their Southerner souls. He said that while they often admitted slavery was an evil in the abstract, they showed, and I quote, at the bottom of their souls, pride and vainglory in their condition of masterdom.
Wow. Pride and vainglory in their condition of masterdom. That's powerful.
Isn't it? He went on to say they tainted principle by making the first and holiest rights of humanity to depend upon the color of the skin. And he declared his ultimate, almost prophetic aim to bring about a day prophesied when slavery and war shall be banished from the face of the earth. This foreshadowed his unwavering moral stand and his deep understanding of the nation's central explosive contradiction decades before the Civil War.
That's incredibly powerful and a remarkably early insight into the fundamental conflict tearing the nation apart. One of his most famous and courageous battles in Congress was against the gag rule, right? Tell us about that.
Yes, the gag rule was a direct assault on free speech and the right to petition, specifically designed to silence any discussion of slavery in Congress. Starting in 1836, the House, largely controlled by Democrats and Southern Whigs, and frankly exasperated by Adams's persistent presentation of anti-slavery petitions from his constituents and abolitionists across the North.
He just kept bringing them up.
Relentlessly. So they imposed a series of resolutions, renewed each session, that automatically tabled, or essentially blocked, any petitions relating to slavery without them being read, printed, debated, or referred to committee. Just shut down the discussion entirely.
And Adams wouldn't stand for it.
Not for a second. For 7 long years, nearly every day Congress was in session, you'd find John Quincy Adams, then in his 70s, rising from his seat, sometimes holding a stack of hundreds of petitions from ordinary Americans, men, women, black, white, abolitionists, concerned citizens, all begging Congress to address slavery in some way, perhaps abolish it in D.C. or stop the interstate slave trade. And each time, he was met with howls of protest, points of order, motions to censure him, even death threats from Southern members trying to shut him down.
He must have been infuriating to them.
Oh, supremely infuriating. He fought actively and often provocatively against this role. He'd use every parliamentary trick he knew, and he knew them all, to try and read the petitions or force debate. He argued passionately that the gag rule violated the fundamental constitutional right to petition enshrined in the First Amendment, and that it subverted the very purpose of legislative debate. He turned the House floor into a battleground for free speech as much as for anti-slavery.
And did he succeed?
Eventually, yes. After years of relentless effort, chipping away at support for the rule, embarrassing its proponents, and rallying Northern public opinion, he finally succeeded in moving the resolution that led to the repeal of the gag rule in December 1844. It was a monumental victory for free speech, the right of petition, and for anti-slavery advocates alike, a testament to sheer persistence.
An incredible fight. And then there's his iconic role in the Amistad case. That's probably what many people know him for today, thanks to the movie.
Yes. The Spielberg film Amistad brought that story to a wide audience. Imagine this. Adams is 73 years old. It's 1841. He's been out of the presidency for over a decade. And he's asked to stand before the Supreme Court of the United States to argue on behalf of a group of African captives who had revolted aboard the Spanish slave ship La Amistad, killed the captain, and tried to sail back to Africa, but ended up in U.S. waters.
A hugely controversial case.
Immensely so. The Spanish government demanded the Africans be returned as property. The Van Buren administration actually supported Spain's claim. Abolitionists rallied to defend the Africans' freedom. Adams, initially hesitant, was persuaded to join the defense team for the appeal to the Supreme Court. He argued for over 4 hours, maybe closer to 8 hours over 2 days, drawing on natural law, the Declaration of Independence, and international treaties. His old man eloquent moniker was never more apt.
And the outcome.
His passionate, learned argument succeeded. The Supreme Court ruled that the Africans were not property, but had been illegally kidnapped and enslaved, and therefore had the right to resist and secure their freedom. They were eventually freed, and with help from abolitionist fundraising, most were able to return to Africa.
Wow.
This iconic moment further solidified his legacy as a moral leader, showcasing immense courage and principles that transcended political expediency. His relentless fight against slavery, both with the gag rule and Amistad, even in a hostile Congress and against powerful interests, demonstrated that he was really the first major national public figure to publicly and consistently challenge the nation's complicity with slavery at the federal level. He planted the seeds for the moral and legal arguments that would fuel the abolitionist movement and eventually the Civil War.
He also vehemently opposed the annexation of Texas, didn't he? Even though he, as Secretary of State, had tried to acquire Texas earlier.
Yes, the context had changed dramatically for him. By the 1830s and 40s, he saw the push for Texas annexation primarily as a Southern scheme to expand slavery's territory and political power to add more slave states and senators. He fought tooth and nail against it in the House for years. And later, he was a fierce opponent of the Mexican-American War, viewing it as an unjust war of aggression provoked entirely to acquire more land for slavery. He was one of only 14 representatives who voted against the war declaration in 1846, a very unpopular stand at the time. Once again, prioritizing moral principle over political popularity or nationalist fervor.
Always sticking to his guns, it seems.
Pretty much. Now, his commitment to public welfare extended beyond just politics and human rights. He was also a passionate champion of science and knowledge. This comes up with the Smithsonian Institution.
Ah, right. How was he involved there?
Well, after this eccentric British scientist, James Smithson, who had never even visited the U.S., died in 1829, he bequeathed his entire considerable fortune, over $500,000 then, a huge sum to the United States government for the founding of an institution in Washington dedicated to the increase and diffusion of knowledge among men.
Quite a gift out of the blue.
Completely unexpected. But Congress didn't quite know what to do with it. For years, the money sat there or was poorly invested, and there were debates about whether to use it for a university, a library, an observatory, or just absorb it into the treasury. Adams became Congress's primary and most steadfast champion for fulfilling Smithson's intent faithfully.
He saw the potential.
He absolutely did. Here's another fascinating detail that illustrates his persistence and foresight. When the initial investment of the Smithson fortune, unwisely put into shaky state bonds from Arkansas, defaulted, Adams successfully argued in Congress to restore the lost funds with interest from the federal treasury, despite strong congressional desires to just cut their losses or use the remaining money for other, more immediate purposes. He insisted the nation had a moral obligation to honor the bequest fully.
That took some doing, I bet.
It did. And it was largely due to his tireless efforts over nearly a decade, chairing committees, drafting legislation, making speeches, that Congress finally passed the act establishing the Smithsonian Institution in 1846. He ensured it would have a non-political board of regents and a broad mission, including a museum, an art gallery, a library, and facilities for scientific research, much like we know it today.
So we owe him a debt for the Smithsonian, too?
In large part, yes. This initiative powerfully demonstrates his intellectual curiosity, his foresight, and his recognition of the critical importance of scientific and cultural institutions for national progress and enlightenment. It shows another facet of his commitment to public welfare that went far beyond conventional politics, a deep-seated belief in the power of knowledge and education to uplift a nation.
And his final act. It's truly the stuff of legend, isn't it? A poetic, almost symbolic end to a life wholly dedicated to service within the halls of power.
It really is. In 1846, when he was 78, he suffered a serious stroke at his winter home in Boston, which partially paralyzed him. But he made a remarkable recovery over several months and insisted on returning to his duties in Congress.
Just wouldn't quit.
Wouldn't quit. Then, on February 21st, 1848, during a debate on the House floor, the Speaker called for a vote on a resolution honoring several U.S. Army officers for their service in the Mexican-American War. That war, Adams vehemently opposed. When the vote was called, Adams, rising to his feet, famously shouted a clear, loud no. He then suddenly collapsed at his desk, suffering a massive cerebral hemorrhage.
Right there on the House floor.
Right there. He was carried into the Speaker's room just off the House chamber. He lingered, mostly unconscious, for 2 days, surrounded by colleagues, friends, and his wife, Louisa, who rushed to his side. He died there on February 23rd, 1848.
And his last words?
His last clearly recorded words were reportedly, "This is the last of Earth. I am content." It's incredibly symbolic, isn't it?
It really is.
Future President Abraham Lincoln, then a freshman Whig representative from Illinois, was actually present in the House when Adams collapsed and later served on the committee arranging his funeral ceremonies. Witnessing the passing of this titan of American politics, this link to the founding generation, his death in the very seat of American democracy, moments after casting a vote entirely true to his deeply held principles, served as a profound, symbolic end to a life literally lived in public service, from childhood diplomacy to his final breath in the Capitol, regardless of personal cost or popular opinion.
What an incredible, almost theatrical way to go. A life lived in service, ending in service. So as we look back on John Quincy Adams's truly extraordinary, multifaceted life, what's his lasting legacy? It's undeniably complex, isn't it?
It is, very much so. He's widely regarded almost universally as one of the most effective diplomats and secretaries of state in American history, a true architect of our foreign policy framework. Yet, as we noted, generally ranked by historians as an average or even less than average president.
How do historians generally sum him up?
Well, they consistently credit him with immense intellectual ability and courage, profound wisdom in perceiving the national interest, at least as he defined it, and perhaps most powerfully in retrospect, a vehement stance against slavery, an advocacy for free speech, women's rights, and Native Americans' rights, particularly in his post-presidency.
But the presidency itself.
His presidential struggles, however, are often attributed to his being a poor politician. In the practical sense, he operated in an era where party politics, organization, and popular appeal were rapidly gaining prominence, and he just wasn't suited for it or refused to engage with it. He saw himself as being above the baneful weed of party strife, as he might have put it, at precisely the wrong moment in American political evolution.
Which raises that critical question for us to consider. What does this tell us about the nature of leadership? Is it better to be a skilled politician, able to navigate the popular currents and build coalitions, or a visionary statesman, steadfast in principle, even if it means political failure, especially when those roles clash?
That's the enduring question his career poses, and it still resonates today, doesn't it? He clearly had the vision, the intellect, the deep understanding of governance and foreign policy, but not always the political savvy, the common touch, or the willingness to compromise that the new age of mass democracy seemed to demand for executive success.
And personally, he was quite a character, wasn't he? Often portrayed as cold and aloof, but clearly struggling with inner demons despite his formidable public image.
He definitely had his quirks and complexities. He preferred solitary reading, long walks, and swimming, often nude in the Potomac, to social engagements. He reportedly suffered from bouts of depression throughout his life, which some historians attribute partly to the immense pressure and expectations placed on him by his formidable parents.
The weight of being an Adams.
Exactly. He often felt inadequate and socially awkward, confiding his anxieties extensively in his diary. And while deeply respectful of his brilliant mother, Abigail, his writings suggest he felt a closer intellectual and perhaps emotional bond with his father, John Adams. Despite these personal challenges, though, his intellect was undeniable. He reportedly had one of the highest estimated IQs of any U.S. president, perhaps around 165.
And the languages?
Oh, the languages. It's truly fascinating and a testament to his global upbringing. He spoke to varying degrees of fluency at least 8 foreign languages: Dutch, French, German, Greek, Italian, Latin, Russian, and Spanish. That's more than any other president. And he's the only one known to have been able to converse fluently in Russian, which he used during his time as minister there.
That's truly remarkable. And he was even something of a maybe unintentional style trendsetter, becoming the first president to regularly wear long trousers rather than the traditional knee breeches and powdered wig that were still common in formal settings.
Right. A small detail, but it shows him moving with the times in some ways. These personal details, I think, offer a more humanizing glimpse into the intensely intellectual and often seemingly rigid public figure. They reveal a sensitive, complex individual driven by powerful internal forces, deep insecurities, and an unwavering commitment to learning and progress.
His legacy is also visible in the lasting clients he inspired, isn't it?
It is. His birthplace and the family home, Peacefield, are preserved as part of the Adams National Historical Park in Quincy, Massachusetts, which is a fascinating place to visit. Adams House, one of the undergraduate houses at Harvard, and the John Quincy Adams Tower at UMass Amherst bear his name. And in a touching continuation of the family's intellectual and public service legacy, his youngest son, Charles Francis Adams, who became a distinguished diplomat himself, built the first presidential library in the U.S. in his father's honor, the Stone Library next to the family home, housing John Quincy's vast collection of over 14,000 books.
Wow, 14,000 books. And I also read that he sat for what some contend is the earliest confirmed photograph of a U.S. president, a daguerreotype, taken in 1843. A truly rare glimpse into his later years.
Yes, that's right. A striking image of the old statesman. And he's been vividly portrayed in film and television, most memorably, as we mentioned, by Anthony Hopkins in the film Amistad, which really captured that fierce, eloquent quality of his later years.
His deep, sometimes troubled family life and relationships, particularly with his parents, his wife Louisa, and his children, two of whom tragically predeceased him, also underscore the immense personal sacrifices inherent in a life of such intense, relentless public service.
Absolutely. And yet his son, Charles Francis Adams Sr., continued that family legacy, becoming a prominent anti-slavery politician, a congressman, and Lincoln's crucially important ambassador to Great Britain during the Civil War, carrying forward many of his father's principles onto the next generation stage.
This continuity through generations of the Adams family really speaks to a profound and enduring commitment to public life and national progress, doesn't it? A rare and powerful example in American history.
It truly is.
So we've journeyed through the incredible, almost unbelievable trajectory of John Quincy Adams, from a child prodigy shaped by European diplomacy, absorbing languages and cultures from a startlingly young age, to a Secretary of State who masterfully defined American foreign policy and expanded its territorial reach. We've seen him as a president with a grand, perhaps too grand, but largely unrealized vision for national development, thwarted by a changing political landscape. And ultimately, we've seen him reborn as Old Man Eloquent, who championed human rights, free speech, and science in Congress, standing almost alone at times against the rising tide of slavery.
Mm-hmm. A remarkable arc.
His life provides such a powerful lens through which you can understand the evolving nature of American politics, that constant tension between pure statesmanship and the demands of partisanship, and the enduring struggle for justice and national identity. He reminds us, maybe more than anyone, that influence isn't always tied to holding the highest office, and that core principles can be fought for and defended, even when it's unpopular, right up to your final breath.
And maybe that post-presidency was his most influential period. It's worth considering.
Definitely. Now, John Quincy Adams famously said in his diary, contemplating that divisive Missouri question decades before the Civil War, "The discussion of this Missouri question has betrayed the secret of their souls. They show at the bottom of their souls pride and vainglory in their condition of masterdom."
Such a piercing insight.
It is. This profound observation, made about the nature of slave owners and the core contradiction of the young American Republic, offers a stark reminder of how deeply ingrained and often unacknowledged biases, prides, and economic interests can drive national policy and personal conviction. So, here's the thought to leave you with, deep divers. What secret of the soul of our own time might John Quincy Adams be trying to uncover today? What issue, if probed to the quick, as he might say, would reveal our deepest collective pride, our most ingrained biases, perhaps even those we struggle to admit to ourselves? Something to ponder long after this deep dive into his extraordinary, complex, and inspiring life ends.